We can hear.
Okay, sir, the recording has started.
Thanks very much, sir. And with this, I'd like to start this 68th call of the CCWG on November 17th, 2015. And I'd like to welcome all of you to this call. It's going to be a two-hour call with an agenda that we've slightly amended in terms of the order of agenda items, but the contents of the agenda remain as publicized on the CCWG list earlier. As usual, we would do the roll call based on those in the AC room. Can I ask who is on the audio bridge only? I understand that Cavus is only on the audio bridge, which is why we're going to add him to the list of attendees. Anyone else only on the audio?
Cavus Arase is on audio only for 20 minutes.
Thanks, Cavus. We've already added you to the list of attendees.
Room, but I'm not in yet.
So who is that? I'm sorry.
It's Phil Corwin. I'm waiting to get in the chat room. I have a software issue, so I'm just on call for the moment.
Okay. So let's add Phil to the list of attendees as well. Anyone else?
Thomas, this is Samantha Eisner. I'm also not in the Adobe room.
Welcome, Sam. Thanks so much for that. We're going to add you to the list as well. Anyone else? Okay, so with that, we should have a complete list of attendees. Can I ask whether there are any updates to statements of interest? There don't seem to be any, which allows us to move to the second agenda item, and the co-chairs would like to briefly give you some additional information on the publication of the summary document. As you know, there has been some communication on the list with respect to the status of the document, what the document's purpose should be. There were some that claimed that it would be premature to tag it a summary report, and this is why we have reacted to your concerns, to the concerns that have been expressed, and we've now labeled this document an update document to reflect the progress that we've made during Dublin and afterwards. And the purpose of the document is primarily to give the community an opportunity to familiarize themselves with our set of recommendations while clearly marking those areas of our report that still require finalization. So there are only a few questions that are still outstanding, and we're going to touch upon all of those during this call. For the remaining aspects of our report, we think that our recommendations are sufficiently stable to be presented to the community. You will remember that in Dublin, there have been some in the community that have claimed that it was difficult to follow our group's thinking without following all the threads, and that it was difficult for them to read the report because the report is quite lengthy, talking about the second report we published now. And this is why we promised to the community that we would come up with a document that explains our recommendations in plain language. And this is what we've now publicized. We think, or we hope, to having sufficiently addressed all of your concerns. We would very much like to invite you to go through the document as it stands with your respective chartering organizations in particular, so that we can hopefully expedite the time needed to come up with comments in response to the third report, which we are going to publish on the 30th of this month. So that we wanted to make clear, so just to, for the avoidance of doubt, again, the summary document is not a summary report spelling out our final recommendations, but it is a snapshot of where we are, clearly highlighting those areas that are still pending final resolution. We would also like to highlight that it's imperative for our work to get the support and the endorsement of chartering organizations. So I'm virtually looking at the members representing the chartering organizations in, specifically. It is your duty and your privilege to liaise with the chartering organizations and ensure that the chartering organizations can react to our third report in time and that they can actually approve our recommendations, our final recommendations, in time to be able to meet the overall transition timeline. So we think that you can start this process now, at least for those parts that are stable. And if you have any ideas on how we can further facilitate your respective chartering organizations or your group's understanding of the report, please do let us know. And I think the whole leadership team, including staff, will be more than happy to help your respective groups understand what we're doing. So with that, I think we can move from the second to the third agenda item, which is the continuation of the mission discussion. And we would like to give the floor to Becky to present to us where we are. But before we do so, let me just briefly respond to Robin Gross, who's asked what the dates for the public comment period would be. Let me say that this is agenda item number 7 in this call, so we will discuss this later on during this call. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Becky. Becky, please.
Thank you. And let me first start by thanking all of the folks in the group who have been participating in the online discussion. I think that we have moved it along. Staff, could I ask you to put up the slide that was that I sent? Great. So on the left, you will see the language that sort of in the immediate aftermath of Dublin we had circulated for discussion. The language that appears in black is the language that is in the second draft proposal. And following that, we had had some conversations in Dublin about clarifying ICANN's contracting authority. Since then, we have had another conversation last week in this call about how we might clarify what we are talking about. And we have two alternatives here. So the first one on the right-hand side, thanks to Andrew Sullivan, reads, that ICANN shall not impose regulations on services, meaning any software process that accepts connections from the Internet that use the Internet's unique identifiers or the content that such services carry or provide. And then there is a combined compilation that I've put together that reflects input from Greg and Milton Mueller and James Bladle, and you will see that there are some square brackets. So the simplest language is, ICANN shall not impose regulations on information services that use the Internet's unique identifiers or the content that such information services carry or provide. There has been further back and forth on this. The suggestion that if we feel the need to provide greater clarity with respect to information services, meaning software processes that accept connections that should be from the Internet. There's another parenthetical that references other than those covered by the registrar accreditation agreement or the registry agreement. And then for those of you who have been watching the list very carefully, you will see that some folks have objected to the language that says that are covered by the registrar accreditation agreement or the registry agreement. So that the language has been some suggestions have been made to morph the language a little bit. And then finally, we have two alternatives on the contract provision. The first and the one that the one that we discussed most recently is that ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements with contracted parties in service of its mission. And Milton has added an alternative that ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce contracts with contracted parties insofar as these agreements are consistent with its mission. So what I would like to see is whether we have agreement with the notion that the language suggested by Andrew, which is designed to be technology neutral, whether that language or some version of alternate two is the language that we want to go with.
Thanks very much, Becky. I just had to get off mute. So let's open the discussion on this, and the first in line is Greg.
Thanks. It's Greg Chatton for the record. Looking at these various drafts, first I think general support for alternative one. I think it is clear and straightforward. Alternative two kind of gets us into apples and oranges issues. By kind of switching what we're talking about when we use the term services, kind of in mid-sentence. In the first half, we define soft services as any software process that accepts connections from the Internet. At least I think that is to clarify what we mean by services, and then and that use the Internet's unique identifiers. And then other than those covered by the RAA and RA, as far as I know, the RAA and RA don't cover software processes, web services, and the like, services happening on the server. They cover business service provider activity, but not services in the sense of software processes that accept connections from the Internet. So I think that's one problem with the bracketed language referring to the RAA and RA. Second problem is this, I think, ties us down. We talk about trying to be technology neutral. This is kind of not neutral in a very different way. It ties us very much to the current and rapidly changing model of who ICANN may contract with. Would not make that reference in any regard, even if it was a logical reference. But I think first and foremost, it's illogical when joined with the concept of the services as software processes. So I would encourage us to stay away from it on both of those grounds. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Robin?
Hi, this is Robin Gross. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I wanted to support the first alternative up there. I think it's the most simplistic that we have that seems more technology neutral and does cover the intent of what we've been trying to achieve about prohibiting some content regulation. So I think Alt 1 would be good, and I also think that the third alternative up there would be a fallback. That would be ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements with contracted parties insofar as those agreements are consistent with its mission. And I like that one because of the limiting clause there at the end, insofar as those agreements are consistent. So I think that that is something that we've been trying to create here all along, which is a mechanism to prevent mission creep. And having that qualifier there will certainly help to make sure that ICANN stays within its bounds, stays within its mission, and can't get outside of it. So I would weigh in on those, on the first alternative out there and the third one. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Milton?
Yes. Can you all hear me okay?
I can hear you all right. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm okay with alternative one if it means what I think it means. The reason I was trying to call out registries and registrars is because I thought that people on the other side of this debate were concerned about the prohibition being too inclusive, that it covered everything, and that they wanted to make it possible for ICANN, which seems to be within its mission, to regulate registries and registrars. So in that respect, if the people who were concerned about this prohibition being too extensive are okay with alternative one, then I'm probably okay with it too. I have a little bit of puzzlement about why we are defining services in this rather obscure technical way when, you know, what ICANN actually regulates is not fundamentally technical but legal and economic. So maybe people could explain to me what exactly the things that would be prohibited from regulating under this provision and what would it not be prohibited from regulating. Can you clarify? Can you give me some concretes?
Okay, I think it would be good for you to respond to that, please.
So I think that what we're talking about is the regulation of a particular kind of service, which is a software process that accepts connections from the internet. And I understand that in the way in which Andrew on the phone? Andrew is on the phone. He could explain that. So
yeah,
technology neutral, and it goes to the service as opposed to the nature of the business, but the connection, the accepting connections from the internet using the internet's unique identifiers. So
could I come back in on that and ask a question? So that's my concern. Are we going to get into some sneaky situation here where, well, I can't regulate something and they go, oh, we're not actually regulating the technical mechanisms by which you connect to the internet. We're regulating your entire business. This is what makes me a little bit suspicious about these purely technical definitions.
What I will go back to and say is that we have a mission statement that limits ICANN to services that reasonably require coordination to preserve the openness and interoperability and stability and security of the internet. And so if ICANN tried to do something sneaky like that, I would say, under what circumstances what you're doing preserve the stability and security of the internet? And by the way, we also have, or the content that they carry. So I at least read this as a for the avoidance of doubt, but not something that replaces the absolute the very clear statement about what is within ICANN's mission statement above it.
Great. Thanks, Ellen, for your patience and allowing Milton to ask a follow-up question. Ellen, before we hear you, I see there is increasing agreement for alternative one. And let me just ask Milton, since he confirmed that he's okay with alternative one now, after Becky's explanations, whether there's anything that we need to tweak in terms of language to make alternative one more accessible and agreeable to everyone. But I sense that, you know, from what we've heard so far, you know, there seems to be a lot of sympathy for alternative one. Ellen, you're next.
Thank you very, very much. My concern is not dissimilar from Milton's. There are, for instance, in the RAA clauses, some negotiated, some as a result of PDPs, that registrars must display certain things on their website. There is also the requirement for a web-based WHOIS. But I'm just looking at saying there are paragraphs that we tell registrars you must display if you have a website. So I don't really want to debate here the right wording. I want to make sure that we have instructions to our lawyers that whatever they draft cannot be used to invalidate those kind of requirements on registrars and registries. So it really is a question of legal drafting to make sure that what we have is ironclad and that the results, the things that we have in our contracts, will not be invalidated. It might be a stretch to say that the requirement of a registrar to put a price, a specific price, on their website would affect the stability or security of the DNS. But yet there are requirements, and we need to make sure that these are honored and can't be invalidated because of this new text we're writing. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Steve?
I think Andrew Sullivan is in front of me. Did we lose him?
Okay. At least on my screen, the hand is lowered. But Andrew, by all means, if you want to speak, make yourself heard.
Okay,
he thinks he can stand mute. So, Steve,
okay.
It's actually your turn.
Great. So it's Steve Del Bianco with the Commercial Stakeholders Group. And within the CSG, there are different views. So I'm not going to express an opinion, but ask the question about when we piece this together, for instance, alternative one and two, will we then turn to the statement that ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements with contract parties? Or are you viewing that as only part of alternative two and it goes away if we pick one? Can you help us to explain the whole page so that as opposed to taking things one chunk of text at a time?
Thanks very much, Steve. Let me suggest to go to Greg now and let Becky answer or react to both of your interventions. I hope this is okay. So let's move to Greg now.
Thanks. It's Greg Shatton. And I was going to actually comment on the sentence that's sitting there, ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements with contracted parties and services of its mission. I don't view that as part of alternative two. I think that alternatives one and two were alternatives to each other, and not in any way, you know, getting rid of anything else there. And I wanted to state my support for the first statement and not the alternative statement of that last sentence. So I think we have two, you know, alternatives to choose from in two cases. So I'm choosing the first alternative in each case. Thank you.
Okay, so Greg is absolutely correct.
Over to you, Becky.
The language ICANN shall have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements is applies whether it's alternative one or alternative two. Can we just, at least based on my reading, we seem to have support for alternative one. And I take Steve's desire to discuss this these holistically, and I think that the answer is yes. You know, in either case, we have, I think, agreement that ICANN should have the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce contracts under some circumstances, and I think the two choices on the table that we've heard are in furtherance of its mission or in service of its mission, or the alternative presented by Milton, which is insofar as these agreements are consistent with its mission. If I might invite comment on this, but before I do, I'd like to just take my rapporteur hat off and say that as a company that enters into contracts with ICANN, I am uncomfortable with the language that leaves that insofar as these agreements are consistent with its mission, because although I want to be able to challenge ICANN whenever it attempts to step over its limited mission and exceed its limited mission by imposing obligations that are not reasonably need to be coordinated to preserve interoperability and openness and stability and security, I also want to understand at the end of the day that I do have an enforceable contract, that it is sufficiently clear and enforceable that I can enforce the terms against ICANN, and that the community knows what it can expect of me.
Thanks very much, Becky. I understand that Greg's hand is an old hand. The request that I have for you, Becky, is you mentioned two alternatives. Milton has offered yet another alternative in the chat. Not sure whether you could see those while speaking, but I'd like to invite you as rapporteur to suggest the preferred option so that we can then test the waters with the group.
Well, I think I've stated my preferred option is the language that it may enter into and enforce agreements with contracted parties in service of its mission.
And have you seen the suggestion made by Milton? Just to make sure that everything was seen.
Not sure which
part. If you look into the notes section, you find
in furtherance of its mission is fine with me too.
Milton, your hand is raised.
Yes, I was simply listing the alternatives that we were debating in service of, in furtherance of, consistent with. I think you must have interpreted that as me suggesting that we throw all three of those in the language, which may not be a bad idea. I guess I just have a question for Becky. It is, what is it you don't like about consistent with? In service of, it implies that, sure, it's okay with me if it's in service of its mission and we've defined the mission. I could live with that probably, but it bothers me that you don't want the word consistent with in there.
Well, so, for example, there's an arbitration provision in the registry agreement. I believe that's clearly in service. Being able to resolve disputes with registries and registrars is clearly in service of and in furtherance of ICANN's mission. The question I have is it consistent? Is somebody going to argue that because ICANN can go to court, it need not, and the stability and security of the Internet or the DNS is not preserved, it should not have an arbitration provision. I mean, what concerns me is this conversation gets perilously close to treating everything in a commercial agreement as part of a policy, and those are the concerns that I have about it.
Becky, I think that what we should do now is, we've heard a lot of views on this point. It looks like people do like the in furtherance language, which is why I suggest we do the would I die for it in the ditch test. You know, this is a process where we need to make sure that we come to consensus. That might not be each and everyone's ideal solution, but let's just hear from those who are absolutely against using the language in furtherance, which I understood got a lot of traction.
Sorry, Thomas, Cheryl, you're asking us to declare the negatives.
I'm testing the waters whether
we want to reject the furtherance language.
Correct, and I'm seeing
I'm caught up with a double negative. Yeah.
I'm seeing objections from Milton and Robin, who don't like the in furtherance language. So just to be clear, we have in service of, in so far as these agreements are consistent with, in furtherance, and consistent with. So let me then check who does not like. Oh, Robin, you wanted to speak?
Yes, please. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So my order of preference for these choices, first would be the in so far as these agreements are consistent with its mission. I think that's the most clear and direct. And then my second choice would be the in service of its mission, because that also helps to keep the activity on target and directly focused on the mission. And the language that I have objections to is the in furtherance of, because that could be, you know, just sort of anything that maybe could be considered a booster or some sort of tangential beneficial activity. And so that just isn't constraining enough, and I'm concerned that that's just too broad for ICANN to resist the mission creep with that language. So that would be the order I would prefer. Thanks.
Okay, Robin, thank you for that. From what I've heard, then let's test the waters for the first option in service of, which was ranking high on your priority list. Becky's good with in service of. Alan supported Sebastian. We move to you now, but before we do, let me just confirm that Caboose has an issue with in service of, as it is not clear in his view, but there are a lot of green check marks in the chat. Sebastian.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know if it's a good time to do worth missing, but just be careful when you use the same word for two different meanings just in the same documents. We are talking about services and we say in service, and I really think that it's not a good idea, at least for me as a non-English first language speaker. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sebastian. Caboose?
Yes, I put in the chat, I don't understand the meaning in service of its mission. I don't understand that. What does it mean, service of its mission? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Caboose. What I suggest we do, Caboose, and I hope that this also addresses your concern, my understanding is that in service of means that it has to support the mission. You know, it needs to be supported by the mission. But I think that Sebastian was exactly right, that we should not try to make this a group wordsmithing exercise. Let us conclude by confirming that this group's preference was in service of, and let's ask the lawyers to come up with a confirmation whether this language would work. They need to make sure that we avoid using the same term in different contexts that might confuse the reader of the bylaws. And let's also ask the lawyers to chime in on the validity of PIC statements, grandfathered PIC statements, and that was also a point that was mentioned in the chat. Steve, you have the final word on this one?
Thanks, Thomas. It's Steve Del Bianco. I have no opinion on the right words to pick to indicate this, but to me, the ultimate test will be if an applicant wanted his contract to include limitations on the behavior of registrants, and that made the way into the contract, would ICANN, when it attempted to enforce that contract, find that it there may not be in furtherance of or fulfilling the mission? And I don't think that we are asking the lawyers to write it so that that's an ironclad yes or no. I think we're asking our lawyers to write it so that the answer to that question would depend. It would depend on the circumstances. And if an IRP was brought to make that decision, it may or may not be within ICANN's mission to force a registry to honor its contract in those instances where that contract spoke to the qualifications of registrants, like they had the banks, or in some cases a community applicant said that community members had to be registrants and couldn't engage in hate speech. And some of those things will just tiptoe over into content. And are we seeking, are the folks on this call seeking to block that out forevermore, or are they seeking to say that under certain circumstances it could be permitted, or is it a wide-open exemption here to say that any registry can put anything it wants in its contract and ICANN has to enforce it? And I'm interested to know what the folks on this call believe we are doing here, because we may walk away from this exercise, Thomas, believing that there's consensus on language, but everybody walks away with a different belief on what the language is intended to accomplish. And if we wait until the end of the public comment period and the chartering organizations to figure out that we all had a different impression, then we will endanger our consensus and we will endanger our deadline. And I know it's uncomfortable, but isn't it better for us to have a better understanding of what we think these words would do? Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. And I would suggest we don't reopen the discussion on this. The lawyers are on the call. They are reading and hearing the concerns, and I'm sure that they will turn around our request to come up with a confirmation of the language pretty quickly. So, Alan, if you could keep it brief, we really have to conclude this topic and move on.
I will keep it brief. I agree with Steve. I believe, and I've said it in an email a long time ago, but I'll repeat it very quickly here. I believe ICANN must be able to put in its contracts content-related things at the request of the contracted party, the registry in this case. I believe those must be enforceable. I believe ICANN would be crazy to accept such content requirements if it were the judge of the content. So I wouldn't want ICANN to have to judge what is hate speech and what is not, but there are ways to get around that using external authorities, which I believe ICANN would insist on. I don't think we need to put that restriction in the bylaws. And there must be, if there are content provisions in the registry agreement, they must be enforceable. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. And that's another comment that is heard and read by the lawyers, and they're surely taking that into account when responding to our request. So I think with that, we can close this agenda item. It looks like we have consensus on the way forward. As said, we're not doing the wordsmithing in this group, but I think that the direction to lawyers, what needs to be encompassed by the language, is sufficiently clear for us to declare this topic solved, which is great news. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Leon.
Oh, that's funny.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Leon Sanchez. And our next agenda item is
an issue that was raised on the list recently, and there has been a couple of interactions on this topic, which is PDP interaction with standard BIOS. There is a specific scenario that Jordan illustrated in an email, in a very clear email to the list, and I think that we have had some feedback on that, and it seems that we might be able to tackle this issue in a very easy way, as Jordan has suggested. But I would like to handle it to Jordan so he can walk us through this email that he sent, and of course the different feedback that we received on that. So, Jordan?
Thanks, Leon, can you hear me all?
Yes, we are able to hear you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's Jordan Carter here for the record, LNZ and Working Party One rapporteur. I'll just brief you briefly on the issue, which is that we've got no intention with our accountability powers to interfere in the normal policymaking that ICANN does through its efforts. I think that's been a pretty widely held principle of the work that we've been doing. But it was drawn to our attention that there might be circumstances where a PDP process in developing some policy required some minor bylaw changes to implement it. Because a PDP process invites comments and input from all the SOs and ACs, and because ICANN structure is set up for each SO to be the policy-making body for it, it didn't seem right to allow the accountability package to leak into that policy-making process. So I was thinking about how you could prevent that leakage happening, how you could make sure that policy processes are have the integrity that they've got today, and that the accountability package of proposals we're putting together doesn't interfere in them. And the simplest way seems to be to say that if a bylaw change is coming from a PDP, the SO that initiated the PDP, that ran it, has to support the exercise of any veto to those bylaw changes. Now, the reason that I came up with that approach in discussion with a few others is because it's the least possible change to our existing set of community powers. So it doesn't say you can never have a veto. It gives that SO the chance to block bylaws changes by expressing its agreement if the bylaws changes that are being proposed, in its view, do not actually meet what the PDP needed. So say randomly the CCNSO does a PDP that requires a bylaws change. It all seems to be going well, but actually people realize that the bylaws change is the wrong one and needs to be stopped. The veto does allow for that. It doesn't create a big problem, I don't think, with broader SO and AC rights of decision, because this is an unlikely scenario to emerge, because the scope of PDPs is relatively carefully controlled in the bylaws already. And because if SO that is doing a PDP is trying to make massive, significant changes to ICANN without consensus, the board will rightly not agree to that PDP anyway. So we're not creating some kind of side mechanism by which SOs can grab control of ICANN if we make this change. I considered a few other options, and they were listed in the email, but they didn't seem to deliver as well as the kind of approach that I've suggested in the email. So the proposal is that any bylaws changes that come from a PDP have to be dealt with as a package. You can't mix up PDP bylaw changes with other bylaw changes to try and slip them through. And that where the escalation process happened, where another SOAC had concerns with those bylaws changes, they could use the first escalation step to have a community call to discuss it. But if there was to be a forum or a veto, the SO would need to support that for it to have any effect. So this is a way to tidy up a probably hypothetical situation, unlikely to be used, but the conversations I've had with people in SOs, particularly in my CCNSO area, are that people are very strong on wanting to preserve the integrity and independence of those policymaking processes, and that not dealing with this hypothetical would pose some pretty serious challenges to being able to agree to the package of accountability improvements. And so that's kind of the proposal in the background, and happy to see what the discussion is like. Back to you, Leon.
Thank you very much, Jordan. I think this has been a very clear explanation, and I see that there is some support and some traction to the proposed way forward. But I would, however, want to open up the floor to see if we have any feedback or comments. And I see Steve's hand is up. I don't know if that is an old hand or a new hand, Steve. That is an old hand. Okay, so anyone would like to comment, or should we call for any opposition as to proceed in the way that Jordan has clearly described? Okay, so I see Milton is asking on whether the proposal is on a slide or on the list in a document. It is on the list. It is on an email that was sent earlier today, well, depending, of course, on the time zone. But it's an email that was received at 1:37 a.m. Mexico City time. So that would give you...
It was sent, Leon, it was sent at 0732 UTC. I guess that's today UTC. So about 11 or 12 hours ago. The subject line is PDP interaction with bylaws veto - proposed approach. I'm sorry I didn't put it into a document, Milton. I probably should have. I just ran out of time.
Thanks, Jordan. So we have support on the chat. So if and I see, of course, some green ticks on the list of attendance. So if there is no opposition, we could proceed with this proposed way forward by Jordan and incorporate it, of course, into the documents. Okay, so we have no opposition. Thank you very much. And our next agenda item is the decision-making thresholds and support. And for that, I would like to turn to my co-chair, Mathieu. Mathieu, are you on mute? Okay, we seem to have a technical problem with Matthew's sound. So, okay. So, let's see if we can fix this technicality.
Leon, I think we should move on. It's my understanding that Mathieu can't speak now.
Okay, good. Okay, so we can handle it. So, would you like to comment on that, Thomas?
So we're moving to point number five now, and I think that Jordan would be best placed to introduce the topic.
Good. Sure, Jordan, could you help us here? Thanks.
I can help you out. Yes, sure, guys. Hi, everyone. It's Jordan here again. So the issue with decision-making and thresholds of support, there is no document for this. I apologize. I'll try to be as clear and concise as I can in describing what the issue is. We've been seeing the discussion on the chat about levels of participation and the voting thresholds that are set out in the decision-making paper. That related to the fact that so far we think we're on reasonably firm ground in saying that the SSAC and RSAC aren't going to be participants in this mechanism, in the community mechanism. In other words, they're not going to be listed in the bylaws as people who might express support or objection to the exercise of a community power by consensus. So that leaves us with five SOs and ACs who are potential participants. The GAC is still examining it, and indeed all the other SOs and ACs haven't had to declare, if you like, a position. Now, you may recall from our earlier discussion of decision making on a few calls ago that for some of our community powers, we've said to exercise them requires the support of three SOs and ACs and no objections from no more than one of them. And for some of the powers, we've said that requires the support of four SOs and ACs and the objections of no more than one of them to exercise the power. Now, people have identified a problem, potential problem with this, in that if we don't know the level of participation that there's going to be consistently across the SOs and ACs, and we know that the GAC has asked for the option to participate to be open but hasn't decided in particular whether it would or not. And some people have raised a concern about the idea that you'd end up with a threshold of four voting, four required to support the exercise of a power. If the GAC wasn't participating, that would require complete unanimity. And unanimity is a principle that we've tried to stay away from. We've said that you shouldn't have complete agreement as a requirement for exercising any of the community powers. So the rapporteurs, I discussed this with Steve a bit and the co-chairs and so on, and a few others have been watching the email. And one way we've thought to get around this would be to make a note in the proposal that said where for each of the powers that have four SOs and ACs required to support, that we could make an indication at the bottom of the table that if only four SOs and ACs were participating, that threshold would be three rather than four. But if your normal five were participating, then the threshold would be four. If any new SOs and ACs were added, assuming we didn't change the decisions around too much, it would still be four. So the table would still list four SOs and ACs being required to support the exercise of the three powers that sets it up. But we would have a situation where if four SOs and ACs were participating only rather than five, the threshold for those three powers that have got four would actually be three. Now, I was going to write this down and send it around in a document, but once again, time got the better of me. So my advice would be that we kick this topic around and that we can see what the discussion is. And then out of that, I can write it up, and we can have a second reading on this issue at the next call. But anyway, that's the intro. Leon Thomas, whichever of you is chairing, you might want to add a bit more if I've missed anything.
No, I think that's been a very good summary of where we are. Ellen, I saw your hand is up. Did you unintentionally take it down, and do you want to speak?
No, I'll wait to see this in writing. Thank you.
Milton.
Yeah, I just have always been puzzled and flabbergasted at the idea, excuse me. That's the Georgia Tech whistle going off. How is it that the GAC doesn't want to either be in or out? I just think this is kind of unacceptable. They have to make up their mind, and we have to judge their appropriateness in that mechanism on the merits. And the idea that you can sit back and say, we want to have the option, but we don't know whether we're going to exercise it, is completely inappropriate for a governance structure of this significance. We have to know how many votes there are. We have to know what the overall complexion, the constellation of the people voting is before we can design an appropriate mechanism. I just think that, who is, what is the problem? I mean, what is stopping them from saying they either want to be in or out? And I see Steve saying it's not just about the GAC, but who else is it about? The other two advisory committees are completely inappropriate to be in this mechanism and have both indicated that they don't want to be. I don't know who else it is. So can we clear that up? I mean, what is the motivation for this kind of option approach to participation in the mechanism?
Thanks, Milton. I'm not sure whether any of the GAC members wants to speak to this. Milton, so far we have taken the approach that we would allow for the constituent parts of the ICANN community to let us know whether they want to be part of the consensus scheme, and if so, in what fashion. And therefore, we never thought it would be appropriate for us to dictate how different groups should be dealing with the exercising of the community power. So that's the situation that we're in. That's the approach that this group has previously taken. As much as you might wish to have a definitive answer to that today, unless GAC representatives want to chime in, I think we have to live with the situation as it is at the moment. Cavus has raised his hand. Cavus and then Alan.
Yes. Is it only relating to GAC here, whether participants or not, or the other things? Because one of the AC, we know that does not participate. The other has not announced. And are we just dealing with the GAC, whether or not it participates? And if it does not participate, what are the options of that? I think we should have two possibilities. One possibility, they participate, we put one, option one, and the other does not participate, option two. I don't think we get any answers from GAC immediately. They are still discussing, and they have not yet announced what they do. So I think you should make a provision that in one case they participate. This is the weighting and number of the vote. And the second option, they do not participate, is the number of votes. And perhaps GAC would decide that in participate in some and not participate in others. They have not yet announced whether they want total withdrawal from the participation or they would like to leave it for the case by case. So why not they have two options? Thank you.
Cavus, to respond to your question, the concern expressed by Milton was specific to the GAC, and this is why I invited you to respond to that. But certainly the question of participation is a broader one. Ellen?
Thank you. I said I was going to wait till the written document, but I think the direction this discussion is going warrants a comment. I believe the issue is in the items where we had four organizations saying they want to exercise the power is problematic if we only have four voicing an opinion and in a given thing. So I don't think it's the question of is the GAC in or is the GAC out. The question is how many organizations for the given power are expressing an opinion for or against. The ALAC may sit out on some particular subject, in which case we're not in the count anymore. So the real question is, if there are only four organizations giving an opinion, then perhaps that's the threshold. That's problematic, because that lowers the threshold from four to three, if some organizations sit out in a particular thing. So I need when Jordan writes this up, I think he needs to be really specific about what participating means, because there are two different versions that could be used. One is participating, as in the SSAC is not, and the other is active in a particular on a particular issue. And I think it's a big difference between the two, and we need clarity. So just as it's being written up, please be specific exactly what we're saying. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Milton?
Yeah, again, I think we're kind of playing word games when we say, you know, oh, we might sit this out, or we might participate or not participate in a particular exercise of the community power. Either you have that power or you don't, okay? If you, what I'm objecting to is the uncertainty about whether someone has it or not. For example, if I choose not to vote in my local dog catcher election, I'm still part of the electorate. If I choose to not vote, it means I don't care or don't have any opinion or any preference, but I'm still part of the electorate. We need to know who is part of the electorate. Everybody needs to know that to have a predictable and stable governance structure here. You can't say, oh, do we need this organization or do we need this level of support to get something through, and then not even know whether a particular organization is going to choose to count itself as part of the electorate. That's just crazy. I don't understand. It's one thing to say that the GAC hasn't made up its mind yet about whether it wants to be in or out, but the idea that it doesn't have to say whether it wants to be in or out, that it can decide opportunistically at any moment in the future, that's just crazy. How can anybody take that idea seriously?
Thanks, Milton. Jorge?
Hello, Thomas. Do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you all right.
Hello, this is Jorge Cancio from Switzerland, for the record. I just wanted to chime in because this discussion reminds me to Los Angeles discussions, Dublin discussions, Working One discussions we have had a lot of times. And I think that we, with these numbers, with these number games, we lose sight of the fact that we are talking about community power. And community power should only be exercised when there is a very wide support from the community. And the community is basically the SOs and ACs we have. So if the petitioner or the petitioning SO or AC cannot convince the other SOs and ACs to support its petition, and they do not represent the vast majority of the community, the community power cannot be exercised because it wouldn't be representing the community. It's as simple as that. And I think that in Dublin, we reached a good compromise on the necessary majority. So why do we keep on trying to tweak that? Thank you.
Thanks, Jorge. Alan again?
I would suggest the answer is simply, if you have not explicitly said you're out, as the SAC has, you're in. Period. Thank you.
Thanks. Ellen? Let me just check whether Jordan is with us. Jordan, since you are going to put something in writing, are you okay with giving us a quick preview of what your findings would be, i.e. what you would like to put in writing so that we get an impression of what we can expect? While you're warming up to this, I see that Caboose's hand is up. Jorge, I understand your hand is an old hand. So Caboose, fire away.
Hello, can I talk?
Yes, please do.
Yes. I raise a question. Suppose only three SO attending or participating. What will happen? What is the threshold? It is probable that ALAC would not attend in participate in one or several issues. Only remains three. What would happen in that case? What will be the threshold? Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Maybe, John, you also have a perspective on that.
Yeah, I think that even if you would never go lower than three, is my view. So if there were only three participating, if they weren't all in favor of using the power, then you would have a problem. So what I would write up is the same as before. I'd write up the assumption about participation. I'd be clear that the way we have to write the bylaws has to make the electorate very clear. Remind people that we've got an expression of support for the use of the community power, an expression of opposition to its use or objection to its use, and the decision to not say anything. Those are the kind of three things that SOs and ACs can do. They could also offer advice on the question without saying anything through the community forum or instead of issuing some kind of decision on their view. And the proposal I'll make is the same as I outlined at the beginning of this discussion, that with the powers that currently require four SOs or ACs to support their use, that if there are only four offering any kind of input, in other words, if an SO couldn't even decide or an AC couldn't decide anything about a comment, that threshold might be lowered to three. And you'll have it in writing and we can debate it on the next call. So that's the pricing. And we can also have a WP1 call later this week to discuss it if that's helpful.
Thanks, John. Do you have an idea of what date we can expect your written summary to go out to the group, just for planning purposes?
In about 6 hours.
That's awesome. And I would suggest that we await the feedback from the group on your proposal, and if need be, we're going to schedule another call later this week. So with that, I think we can close this topic. Thanks all for a very interesting and engaged discussion.
Just one moment. One more comment for Jordan.
Okay, I thought that was an old hand cover, so I apologize.
No, it's a new hand. Could Jordan also envisage that in case that the number is below certain SO or AC together, there would be no possibility to exercise community power? For instance, with three. If it is three or equal to three, less or equal to three, it may not be possible to exercise the power. So we should foresee that situation for further discussions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Caboose. Jordan has heard your comment, and I'm sure that he will take that into account. And he confirms in the chat that he has noted your point. So with that, I'd like to thank Jordan in particular for presenting and providing guidance on these topics. Number four and number five on the agenda. And with that, I think we can move to the stress test 18 subgroup update. And for that, I'd like to hand over to Mathieu.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Mathieu Vey speaking, and I apologize for the for joining this call late due to some housekeeping issues. This update is a follow-up on the update we had last week on the stress test 18 discussion, which is one of the outstanding discussions. Since our last call, there's been a lot of work, and we've held the first conference call of our subgroup, and it I can say that it was a very constructive call, and everyone was really open and listening to everyone's perspectives. Our work is looking at the various options that have so far been considered. And there are four options being looked at more closely. Of course, there's the current bylaws. There is the option that is described in our current report, in the second CCWG report. There is the proposal by Brazil, which was circulated after Dublin on our mailing list. And there is another proposal which was put forward during the last few days by Denmark, and which is very much work in progress as it is currently being fine-tuned on the list. The discussions are not surprisingly focused on the definitions, or at least the level of flexibility in the definition of what is a consensus GAC advice, as well as discussions on levels of board support for a decision that would lead to acting in a manner that's not consistent with GAC advice. And that those are the key aspects of those that will differentiate the different options. However, I'd like to stress that there are a number of common views expressed in this group. There are significant commonalities here. So discussion is, I think, showing some encouraging signs. The gaps are not breached, definitely not. We are not in a position right now to report on some form of agreement that could be reached, and time is very short. So we're working at another call, which is scheduled tomorrow, so Wednesday at 13 UTC. And we know that our deadline to come back to the CCWG was something where the as co-chairs, we could assess whether we have a way forward for our third report. Our deadline is certainly next Monday in time for the Tuesday call at the latest. So that's the update on this item, where a lot of work is being undertaken at this point. And obviously, feedback is welcome during this call. We are listening to everyone and would convey any input to the subgroup so that the call that takes place tomorrow can take that into account if need be. That's my update, and of course I would like to open for questions or comments, if there are any. So I see a question by Arun in the chat, who is asking whether the subgroup is working on a definition of consensus. Different options we are considering, there are different approaches to definition of consensus. So in a sense, I would say yes, but it would be wrong to say that the group itself is trying to find a definition of consensus, but there are different options with different levels of different ways to assess consensus. And Steve is next in the line. Steve, please.
Thanks. It's Steve Dalbianco. Arun, there is no attempt to instruct the GAC or any AC and SO of what its internal rules are, but there is a lively discussion to tell our board of directors what to look for in advice as far as a level of consensus that should drive our board to have to go to a two-thirds vote to reject it, or require our board to enter into negotiations to try and find a mutually acceptable solution. So we do talk about consensus in the Stress Test 18 group, but we're talking about instructions to our board of directors, leaving it to the GAC to do whatever it wishes, but reserving the extra special deference and the two-thirds only for when a certain level of consensus was reached on that particular piece of advice. So it's more complex, I think, and yet at the same time, there's no attempt to tell any AC and SO what it must do, but instead giving an incentive for that AC or SO to have a higher level of consensus to get a higher level of deference from the board. And it's a complex decision, and there's a lot of discussion in depth on the Stress Test 18 subgroup. So I want to be sure and invite, you know, everyone on this call who's interested in this topic to, you know, to please enroll in the Stress Test 18 subgroup, or failing that, at least make sure that you understand what time we're having a call tomorrow, and please join the call and participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Next is Caruso. Caruso, we can't hear you.
Yeah.
Okay,
can
I can
you
hear
me
you
now? Is okay?
Yes.
Can you hear? Yes, okay. First of all, as I mentioned in my email, I would like to express my condolence, my sympathy and passion to you, your organization, your people, all of them that have suffered from this very barbarian attack in your country and your people and so on and so forth. This is something very important. We are a member of the LIMB and we have to be really alerted of all of these things. We are connected to each other. This is number one. Number two, I don't understand some people that they are not aware of what is the public policy, which is for the government. Why Milton wants to exclude GAC to give any advice, that if I can object to the advice, I can get into the negotiations in order to find a workable solution. What is wrong with that? Negotiation is everywhere. Why Milton is against negotiations? He's a one-sided man. He doesn't want any negotiation. Dictatorship. This is this. You like it or don't like it, that's all. Negotiation is everywhere. In every organization, we have negotiations. Why he doesn't want that I can get into the negotiations with the GAC to see whether or not they could find a workable solution. At the end, I may not agree with that, but that is that. But why he's talking about privilege? It's not privilege. It's a public policy issue explicitly for the government, and you have to work it out. This is from the very beginning that you encourage the GAC to remain advisory committee, not being a decision maker. So I don't understand why we are going to say that thing, opposed to that. What opposition it means? This is anti-GAC motions, anti-GAC orientations. I don't understand the CCWG. I don't understand this sort of thinking. Let us work together. I don't see this is valid. This is valuable. This is logical. Thank you.
Thank you, Caruso, both on your first point and your intervention. Jorge?
Hello, Mattia. Did you hear me?
Yes, Jorge, please.
Okay, thank you. This is Jorge Cancio, Switzerland, for the record. I just want to concur with what Mattia was explaining. Think about this subgroup. I think there has been a very constructive atmosphere in the discussions so far. We're trying to see what the requirements, concerns of each party are, and to analyze them and see what responses we can come up with. So I really would invite all interested members of the CCWG to take part in the discussions, because if we keep it on a rational and requirements-based level, I think there could be opportunities for a good consensus. Thank you.
Thank you, Jorge. Milton?
Yes, I just wanted to respond to the repeated invitations to join the group, pointing out that there's also another group going on with relation to the intellectual property of IANA, and there have been so many conflicts between those calls and the Stress Test 18 group call that I have been unable to really straddle both of them in connection also with my day job. So I don't want to make it seem as if my inability or unwillingness to participate in that is really some kind of irresponsible attempt to not deal with the committee as a whole, simply that it's not possible to be on that and do all the other things that are being required at the moment. I do want to, I guess I do need to respond to Caruso. The business about negotiation is all very fine and good. Let's say that the GNSO could offer advice to the GAC, and the GAC had to negotiate with us as to whether they could actually issue their advice. I think that would turn the tables a bit, wouldn't it? And I think you'd find that that was a very burdensome requirement. It's simply the problem with GAC advice under the current system is that the bottom-up process develops a very painstaking consensus about something, which the GAC typically is not part of, and then the GAC can issue advice to the board, which maybe completely contradicts what the consensus that was reached by the actual community, and then we are in a very unstable situation where we have to renegotiate, in effect, the consensus. So this bylaw consensus under the present system is very powerful because it's basically a holdup. It prevents anything from moving forward until whatever differences the GAC has with a policy and the board are reconciled. And I think, you know, apart from how good an idea that is in the existing process, it's something we cannot have happen in a community enforcement mechanism because that, again, would cripple it. It would make it impossible for the community to reach a consensus in a timely fashion on any matter.
Thank you, Milton. Jorge, is that a new hand? No, it was an old hand. Okay. So thank you all for these inputs, and we certainly apologize for the conflict on the calls, but given that our time is very limited before we can come to a conclusion, we haven't been as rigorous as usual in avoiding conflicts, and that puts an extra burden on us in the group to provide clear feedback to the CCWG about the requirement approach we've taken, as well as the rationale that put us in a position to consider the proposals when we are ready for that. And hopefully we can do that, and bear in mind that you will probably hear from our group a little before the next CCWG call and be asked to consider options at that meeting next Tuesday, and we won't have much time to regroup after that. So that's going to be an important agenda item. And with that, I'd like to move to the timeline discussion, the next agenda item. Leon, is that you chairing this part, or is it Thomas?
I can do that if you want. So our next agenda item is on the timeline, and we have received, of course, feedback from many of you in regard to the tight timeline we are moving on these days. And just as a reminder, we have, published the formal update, and the staff is working on delivering a full proposal for the CCWG to review. This is scheduled to happen on November the 20th by midnight UTC, and from there we will have from the 21st to the 23rd to gather feedback from working party groups, and by we, I mean the chairs and rapporteurs. And then we will have the final comments on the full proposal content due from the CCWG by midnight UTC. So this leaves from the 20th to the 23rd for the full CCWG to comment on the proposal. And in the meantime, we will be running a parallel timeline with the chairs and the rapporteurs to gather feedback from working party groups. Then on the 24th and 25th of November, we will be, of course, going back and forth and finalizing the content between staff and the coaches and the writing team that is holding the pen. And on the 25th, we will be concluding the formatting of the content due for translation. And on November the 30th, we would begin the public comment phase 2, which would, of course, enable everyone to comment on the full proposal. And we will also begin, in parallel, the professional proofreading and final editing of the detailed proposal. And we will be sending this also to translation. And we expect to have this translated documents by December the 12th, and also to receive the final proofreading and editing by December the 20th. Then, on December the 21st, we would be closing the public comment period, and by December the 24th, staff would have ready a summary of the public comment for review of the CCWG. So this is the timeline as it stands, and we are aware that it's a very ambitious timeline. We are aware that we're working on a lot of pressure here and with very little time, but we do feel like we can achieve the deadlines that I have gone through. And I think that you all have this timeline on your inbox. I'm not sure if you have it, but if you don't, we will be sure, or we will make sure that you have it on your inbox. And at this point, I'd like to open the floor for comments, and I see Steve Delbianco's hand is up. Steve?
Thank you, Leon. The first two documents we put out, we were very attentive to what we called public comment, but we were also hoping that the six chartering organizations would take a very careful look at the proposal and give us whatever the recommendations that chartering org had particular concerns about. That is even the way we phrased the second public comment. We said, are there elements in here that might prevent your chartering organization from supporting the recommendation? And I think the document we published this past weekend was careful to delineate the recommendations, a dozen or so explicit recommendations, and I think that teased it up very well for the six chartering organizations to quickly run through and focus on which of these recommendations do you have further questions and concerns about, so that when the details emerge in about 2 weeks, they can dive in and understand whether they can support it or not. So I'm really making this point to remind everyone that we have to focus on the chartering organizations. It's their support or opposition to the recommendations that matter most. If there are individuals out there in the global internet public that want to provide individual public comment, they can do so. We never turn that away. But it's most important for those of us on this call to work through our own chartering organizations. For me, it's the GNSO. For Milton and Robin, it's the GNSO. For Alan, it's the ALAC. It's all of us through our chartering works that have to come to the decision. It really isn't about another round of public comment where individuals lob comments in and we tally them up and do a public comment analysis. I think those days are done. Our charter calls for us to get the approval of the chartering organizations, and that's really where we need to focus our efforts.
Thank you very much, Steve. And yes, you're right. We are hoping that, of course, the chartering organizations will be able to provide us with feedback, of course, from the document that we have provided, and there have been also requests in this call for some webinars, and I think that, as Thomas said, we will be able to, of course, provide those webinars so we can better engage with the different chartering organizations, so we can all be in time with any feedback that we want to provide after the publications of these documents. So can I have Thomas? Thomas?
Thanks very much, Leon. And I'd like to add to this that the burden is very much on the members from the chartering organizations at the moment to liaise with their respective groups at different levels. First of all, a lot of what's going to be in our final recommendations is not new. So you can already educate and populate the findings and the recommendations that are stable. Secondly, you can help make the finalization of the report so efficient that there is little or no risk of friction when it comes to the approval. And you can do that by chiming in when it comes to finalizing the report. Please do make sure that you monitor what we're putting in the report and that you chime in when we're actually finalizing. And when it comes to finalizing, what we can offer is to hold specific calls where we discuss with you your comments on specific sections of the report. So we would streamline the process of soliciting feedback from the whole CCWG, and we could have dedicated calls. So think about that. We're standing by to offer that. Thirdly, when it comes to the publication of the report, you can help your respective groups understand what the final tweaks are that we made. So at this at these levels, you can help us not needing as much time as we would if all the material that's going to be in the third and final report is brand new. And the participants that are in our group can specifically help make all this very efficient, because you are not encumbered with the duty of liaising as a member with your respective groups, so you will play an equally important part in this process. So let's please make this a group exercise. Let's not forget that while we made important changes to what we had in our second report, I would say that like 90% or even more remain unchanged, and this is what you can already discuss and highlight with your respective groups. I think it's perfectly possible to deliver on the timeline that you see in front of you and on the overall public comment period if we use our time efficiently. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for your continued commitment to this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Next on the queue, I have Holly Gregory. Holly?
Hi, Leon. Hi, Thomas, Matthew, and CCWG. We just wanted to know whether you're going to want legal review of the draft, and if so, when we should be prepared to set aside time to do that.
Thank you very much, Holly. Yes, we will be getting in touch with you and coordinating if we do need the legal review from your side. I guess it will not be a full review, but rather only on those points that that are new on the document that would of course would need to go through you in order to be checked on the legal side. So yes, we will definitely get back to you and have, of course, a formal confirmation on whether we actually be engaging with you to have this review on the document.
We would appreciate a heads up in advance so that we can make sure that we have people available.
Of course, Holly, thank you. We will make sure to give you that heads up as soon as possible.
Okay, terrific. Thanks.
Thanks, Holly. Next on the queue, I have Milton Miller. Milton?
Yes, I'm going to be urging you to be a bit more realistic about this timeline and to change it. Somebody in the chat has already suggested that you need to add about 7 or 8 more days to this, and since that pushes you past Christmas into close to New Year's, it's not like that's going to make a big difference in the overall schedule of the real bottleneck here, which, of course, is what happens in Washington, D.C. So you have only, I guess, 3 weeks here for the public comments from November 30th to December 21st. I think also the staff summary of public comment for review, maybe you can do that in 3 days. I think that's a bit tight. You might want to add a day to for the between the proposal content and the final comments for greater discussion. I suspect there will be a few problems here and there that people will catch. Generally, I just think I have to completely disagree with Steve Del Bianco when he's questioning the entire need for a public comment. You have to understand that one of the NTIA criteria is widespread public support. And since you have deviated significantly from the last plan, the proposal that was circulated, the CWG has to certify that this meets its needs. I just don't see how you can not have a very important commitment to another public comment period and a careful review and summary of those public comments. You have to demonstrate to the NTIA that what we're proposing has widespread public support. And that doesn't mean the chartering organizations, that means the public.
Thank you very much, Milton. I think that we will be actually analyzing what can be done in terms of timeline. I mean, it might be it might come to the point in which we actually need to rearrange some dates, but we would like to also have all members to actually buy into delivering their charging organization support around January, mid-January, as it has been stated, and we wouldn't like to actually extend the timeline if it's not something that actually needs to be done. So, as I said, or I'm trying to say here, is that we would pretty much like to stick to this timeline that you are seeing here in your screen, but we are not close to the fact or to the possibility that we might actually have or we might actually need to extend it for a couple of days more or some days more. And I see that Athena has her hand up. Athena?
Yes, hello. This is Athena Saguli. I agree with you, Leon. As a matter of fact, we would like to express a very strong opposition to an extension of this timeline. Then it's a tight timeline, but we were anticipating for the final proposal to be ready for November, and we were hoping later on for December. We accepted January to tolerate the stage of the discussions, but we cannot wait any longer because the whole IANA transition will be jeopardized, and this is very crucial. Also, with regards to Steve Del Bianco comment, of course, I cannot talk on his behalf, but the way I understood his comment, and that's why I supported it, it was not that there won't be a public comment period. I think what he meant or what I would support was that the public should channel their comments through the SOs and ACs instead of having individual contradicting, let's say, comments from the same area of a certain community of an SO and AC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Athena. And I see some comments on reviewing the whole proposal by the lawyers. And while we very much appreciate the comment from our lawyers, I think that there are some parts of the proposal that have already gone through all types of reviews, not only from our lawyers, but from the larger community, and I think that we would need to focus any reviews on the new elements that are being drafted in this final version of our document. And as the chartering organizations make their consideration for this final proposal, then we would be able to carry this review of these new elements in parallel. So I think that this could enable us to stick to our timeline while we also receive the always valuable feedback from our lawyers on these new elements. So at this point, I see different reactions on the chat. And I believe that we could go to having this timeline as the compromise for our group. And, of course, as I said earlier, we will be closed to actually considering some flexibility at a certain point. But, of course, trying to stick to this timeline as best as we can. So I'd like to turn now to our next agenda item, which is any other business. And this would be something for Thomas or Matthew. I'm not sure. Thomas or Matthew?
Sure. And maybe this is going to be a quick and easy one. Does anyone have any other business to discuss? So I understand that hot hand is an old hand. And Greg is suggesting that we're going to have a musical exercise in Marrakesh to maybe celebrate our achievements. Let's see what we can make out of that. So there don't seem to be any volunteers for any other business, so that we can actually give back 17 minutes of your valuable time and finish this call early. Next steps have been laid out clearly by Leon in the previous session on timeline. Thanks, everyone, for your constructive participation in this call, and have a great day. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, all.